Ronnie, I was comforted by your opening remark concerning incredible dialogue. And I know that everybody here can only hope for peace in the Middle East and a Palestinian homeland that is substantial. Would you think it would be credible dialogue for both those who voice their opinion, pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli, come together to network for that peace? And in South Africa, did you ever have a youth symposium for understanding inequality? Such could be a guideline for what could take place in Montreal.
Je crois qu'il vaudrait mieux que je me présente. Je viens du Liban, du sud-Liban. J'ai vécu la guerre de 2006. Je continue à voir les victimes, les enfants qui sont touchés par les plastic bombs, dont des enfants qui sont de ma famille. Je suis musulmane sur ma carte d'identité, mariée à un homme chrétien. Et ma meilleure amie s'appelle Muriel Hakim. C'est une juive qui vit à Paris et qui est venue nous épauler durant l'invasion de 82. Elle a quitté son boulot, sa vie, et est venue assister, elle, avec nous, à Beyrouth Ouest en 82. Juste cette introduction pour que vous sachiez de quel background je suis en train de vous. Aujourd'hui, je viens de lire, comme par hasard, un texte de Walter Benjamin sur la violence et le droit. Et il distingue, il critique, il donne une vision critique sur deux genres de droit. Le droit légal et le droit naturel. Le droit naturel qui justifie les moyens pour les fins. Et le droit légal qui traite des moyens. Il dit que les moyens doivent être égaux pour que la fin soit faite. Ce texte m'a posé tout d'un coup, m'a mis toute l'histoire du conflit israélo-palestinien, israélo-libanais devant mes yeux. Nom de Dieu, quel genre de droit, c'est-à-dire quelle différence y a-t-il entre violence et terrorisme et droit? Pour un peuple à qui on a mis tous les moyens, qui n'a pas d'autres moyens, mais pour nous tous qui vivons au Canada, en Australie ou à South Africa, nous avons ces moyens. Alors il faut les utiliser tous. Et l'exemple qu'a donné monsieur là, c'est-à-dire si on travaille, on fait stopper le train pour une minute, ça fait une grande différence. Alors, s'il vous plaît, multipliez les actions, n'importe où, que ce soit dans la rue, dans les maisons, si vous dansez, si vous chantez, si vous faites n'importe quoi. Merci.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Ronnie. I just have two questions, maybe a bit similar to the first question, but which is a question of strategy. And you talked about the importance of strategy, and it's been 4 years since the call for BDS has been made, and there have been some humble gains made by the movement, but what you feel that we could be doing now to further the BDS, and what lessons this far in as an anti-apartheid movement we can learn from South Africa. And the second question, which many people say, well, Palestine solidarity is different than that of South Africa. There isn't the same Palestinian leadership that existed with that of the ANC, and your thoughts on that, and on that question of Palestinian leadership in terms of the Palestine solidarity movement.
So before Ronnie starts, if three more people can put their hands up, I'll select them and then. So go ahead and answer.
Okay. The first question, thanks. I would think that it's very good to try and encourage a situation of people coming together in a sober and disciplined way. I can't say that it's that easy. We know that this is a very emotional issue, and people feel things very deeply. In South Africa, we always, even in the worst period under apartheid, and I know when I was at university, like 1960, only whites on the campus, and there might have been in a whole university maybe four or five of us who actually were saying that racism is wrong and trying to debate, and at times being totally held down. But through perseverance, at times in a good environment, having talked to various people and finding those who were genuine, sincere about wanting to exchange views, that we would then find a situation where maybe in somebody's house we'd have 20 people, maybe even 10 people, and discussing things and trying to resolve problems. So this is very interesting and very important to try and make such contact. So one encourages that. We made headway with this in South Africa, even in the 1960s, that period. Then the repression became so great that nobody could do this that I'm referring to, because you were either in exile or in prison if you were from the anti-apartheid side, the ANC side. But when the wheels started coming off the apartheid bandwagon, then you found people in their multitudes from the white side wanting to find out what is going on, who are these guys, what's Mandela really like, well, tell us more about your policy. So what's very, very important is to constantly project one's position and one's policy, and it should be a broad-based one. This was the strength of the ANC's, deriving out of the position that I explained from the Freedom Charter about South Africa belonging to all who lived in it, and actually having examples of whites who were members. But what's amazed me, talking to many generations of Israelis and Palestinians, going back to the 60s, I was outside the country and in exile, but one met these people very often at international conferences, but outside that as well, and finding that there was a tremendous history and tradition from the very early part of that century of Jews and Arabs, if I use that term for the Palestinians, living within the British Mandate and getting on very well. And we had for a brief period of time in South Africa an ambassador. It was during the time of Oslo, and he was a political appointee, old guy. And he was in South Africa. We had the Israeli and the Palestinian ambassador there. And these guys were close friends. And I asked about it, and they explained how they used to live next door each other. And some harrowing story going up to 1947 and so on. We both lost. One guy lost the wife, the other guy lost the mother through terrorist actions by the Jews who identified the Palestinian ambassador's family and the extent to which he and his family were involved with Jewish people. And the on the Palestinian guy's side, his mother died as a result of some Israeli army action. But it's there in that older generation, because the Palestinians and a lot of those early socialist inclined Israelis had something of an understanding in a period when within what we call Israel, within Israel, not talking here about the occupied territories, where people were getting on, not every family, but there were these cases, and that's what we had in South Africa as well. So when I meet, as I did, I'm in at SOAS, School of Oriental African Studies, last Saturday night to speak, and there are Palestinian guys there, and they take me out for dinner afterwards, and there's this young student with them, and very dark hair and eyes and so on. I took her to be Palestinian or Arab, and she'd been very quiet, one of these background people. And there were quite a lot of us, so I get around to asking who she is, you know, well, where are you? Are you Lebanese or whatever? No, 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 I'm Jewish from Israel. And you can see that there is this synergy. It is possible. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to find that, despite what I've made reference to, that Zionism is the worst enemy of the Jewish people. Because we've had a whole history of Jews and Muslims, Jews and Arabs living together. It was the Muslim peoples, the Arab peoples of the Mediterranean basin that gave the Jews shelter so many occasions throughout history. I'm an optimist and I believe that that is going to be possible in the future because of the signs that we've seen, and the signs are growing. So certainly we should look at the symposium of people coming together, and it is happening. Where you find, I've got a lot of dear friends in Britain because of the South African connection there, and this movement amongst Jews and Arabs of coming together and studying and writing together and rediscovering that wonderful culture of the Mediterranean region that was dominant for so many centuries. And you see, I forgot the name of the mayor of Jerusalem. I think his name's Ben Visti or something.
Ben Benazi.
I mean, his stuff's wonderful. And he's been invoking all this. This is where what we're doing here. This is what's healthy, this is what's progressive, this is bringing people together. And yes, if you're Jewish, given what Zionism has done, and this enormous preponderance of the Israeli resource and power, is it something that makes you feel ashamed and so on? And sure, it does, as this has happened with white South Africans, confronting the real truth. But this is where they found, and I've made reference to it, that they become liberated in South Africa of all this false consciousness. On the question of thanks, that wonderful input from the Lebanon, and very moving. I took it as more of comment and commentary. But the point made about multiplying these small little victories, 2-minute victory in Oslo, all of these little victories, these little actions, they build up, they form a critical mass, and they begin to make enormous change, and it's happening. It's really been happening. They made a major error in the way they dealt with the people in Gaza. And the whole world has seen this brutality. That's where the big change has come. And we've got to help people to understand this and build a solidarity movement. And then finally, the question of the BDS. There are big differences. The ANC we've been very fortunate in our struggle in that we had one mainstream liberation movement which for all the period of that struggle was ascendant and had the respect and the support of our masses of people internationally and maintained a remarkable unity. It doesn't mean that there weren't other organizations. There were quite a number trying to capture the support from the ANC and using demagogy, and the PAC went in for blind assaults and attacks on white civilians, etc. But, you know, even with us, the situation in South Africa at present, and it's not a subject here, and we're not going into it, and it's a whole different thing. We're having a lot of tension and differences now within the ANC. But we've come to power, we've delivered to our people, and quite frankly, I say that if my mother or this one or that one wants to go and vote for somebody who I don't like, fine. That's democracy. And I'm pleased that I've helped them make the damn mistake they're going to make in putting the cross on the ballot for somebody else who I don't like. We've done that. We've got through that. But the Palestinians faced a far more powerful enemy in the end than we did. And in the situation of struggle, and it goes back to the previous question from the lady from the Lebanon, where the differences are so huge in what the ruling power and its resources has and what the underdogs have, that little wonder that in history we find those who resist struggling to find the best way and getting frustrated and going down this avenue and that avenue, and with the Palestinians going unfortunately into a period of suicide bombing and justifying it by saying, well, there's nothing else that they could do. You know, I'm not here to say what they could have done in that situation, but I think there's a lot you can do without blowing yourself up. So in terms of the strategy for BDS, I just want to mention this because the time's going, this is a long issue. It wasn't easy for us to get the BDS going. We had a situation in 70s and 80s particularly where amongst the most reactionary people Britain or America have had, President Reagan and Thatcher, were at the helm and called Mandela himself a terrorist. But that was the period where our mobilization got to the greatest possible heights because it was the people who were prepared to support us. And we had to find a creative way in which to mobilize that opinion, mobilize those people. And then, of course, find a way also of putting certain pressures and bringing influences and so on to bear on those running the countries that were apartheid's allies. And this is what this movement has to follow through and investigate in terms of peaceful, disciplined mobilization.
Almost answered my first question, which was going to be, I realize as you're talking, I don't think some of us here really know that much as we would like to, about the anti-apartheid movement that happened in the 1970s or 1980s. And I was just curious, you said you were living abroad during some of that time, about the kind of arguments that you encountered against what you were doing. If you encountered arguments that were from people who were, as you call it, you know, allies of apartheid, or if it was just from people who maybe said, the tactics you're proposing, you know, why should we get involved, why should we do this? Was it people that were actually critical of what you were doing, or just kind of trying to silence you through other kind of less formal means? And my second question was that sometimes when I hear people talk about this week and they point out the fact that it's not a completely parallel situation. They point to the fact that there is violent resistance happening in Palestine, and you mentioned that there was also violent resistance that happened in South Africa, and I feel like I don't really know very much about it at all, and I'm curious if you could just tell us maybe a little bit more.
Hi, my question is more concerned about historical narratives. For about all of apartheid South Africa's history, there were notions that if blacks were fully enfranchised, that it would spell the end for South Africa. They were terrorists, they would rape and pillage. I was just wondering if you could elucidate a little bit more what white life is now in South Africa and how that applies modern day to the Israeli narrative, and how you foresee Jewish life in the state of Israel vis-a-vis the South African experience.
My question was more kind of about liberation in South Africa and what comes after that, maybe what we could apply to a liberation struggle for Palestine. Because my understanding was throughout the anti-apartheid struggle, the ANC and many black people in South Africa had the Freedom Charter. So a charter of demands and aspirations that people, I've heard accounts that even people, regular people, had it posted up in their homes, that that kind of embodied what the national liberation struggle was, and written in that was their economic aspirations for economic equality and justice. And I think in a lot of ways, I mean, apartheid ended in South Africa in 1990, but I've heard by many accounts that people are still restrained and you know, held back by a lot of the very similar economic systems that they suffered under apartheid. And in Palestine, I've been to Palestine twice, and the second time I was there, I attended the Palestine Investment Conference, where you had a lot of businessmen meeting to basically map out neoliberal plans for a future Palestinian state. And that some people I interviewed there were basically saying, you know, this is not what we're fighting for. This is not what we envision. And so I'm just wondering, like, you know, what kind of lessons we could draw, and like how you could apply that. You know, is liberation more than getting a state? You know, what would that mean, and what kind of lessons maybe we could apply from what went wrong with the anti-apartheid movement and you know, the economic injustices, especially that exist South Africa today?
That first question, the kind of problems we found in building the movement, the anti-apartheid movement. You know, I think back on that period, it was very, very difficult. We trudged the streets. One would get in a train. I lived for 10 years in London. Other towns, one's roles changed. So you heard about my military background. For a lot of the time, I was actually in the forests of Angola, Mozambique, and so on. But there were about 10 years in which I was based in London with other comrades. There were comrades here in Canada. We had terrific groups here. And we would literally go out on a cold winter night and have to take the train for 2-3 hours to get to Birmingham or Manchester or somewhere and try and find down a wet, cold street a meeting place. And come there and there'd be 10 people at that meeting. And your approach was never to show disappointment. And if there were 10 people, there were 10 people to talk to. And of course, there were lots of times when the meetings were of this nature and sometimes even bigger. So you realized and that you were in for the duration and that you would carry out the work and your tasks. And of course, there were all sorts of questions and queries. And especially those who had come to meetings were already more in a frame of mind of just wanting to have the information, the education. But we were being attacked like you are now in the media, in the press. the question of an academic boycott, the question of a sports boycott. This is sports got nothing to do with politics, and why are you coming and you're spoiling this whole thing? And, you know, huge pressures that way. And, of course, you'd have to motivate your own critical force for them to understand how all of these things together make a huge difference. So it's about grassroots organizing. It's about building up from the base. It's about finding the correct tactical approach and the correct identification of the issues. In relation to violent resistance, I think there the question was about what violent means were used in South Africa. Well, we had something of guerrilla actions taking place. We didn't have the forests of, as I said, Vietnam and Angola and so on. We put the political mass struggle, that is our number one focus. And with armed actions, usually sabotage, sometimes attacks on the military and so on, sabotage actions against communication means in South Africa, or the identification of the targets of apartheid and oppression, which tended to inspire our people a huge amount. There were some times when bombs were put in restaurants, which we soon stopped. And the thing about it was the black people loved it and would get very excited. And we'd have to tell our combatants that we don't care what you're telling us, that they're loving this in the townships. It's the wrong thing. Because in the long run, it's going to be counterproductive. But just by way of contrast, in Vietnam, where they had similar formulas, you know, mass political struggle, the underground activity, international solidarity, and their military. But in Vietnam, the military was the main priority because they had liberated North Vietnam. They had all these weapons from the Soviet Union through which they could fight first against the French and then later the Americans and, you know, the puppet forces, etc. So that's just very briefly an aspect of our armed action, but one in which we told our people from the start, as in, I repeat again, that we're not fighting the elimination of a people. We're fighting to erode a system. And that's what it is, and we must concentrate our forces and our mobilization to isolate that system and those responsible for that system. And then the question of how's the situation in South Africa now? And I thought the question I asked about Jewish life in South Africa, it was Jewish life in South Africa, right? I don't know where the person is. How's the life of white people in South Africa? They've never had it so good in terms of the economy, because by 1990, when de Klerk had decided that if we don't make change, this economy is going into the gutter and there'll be revolution writ large, we better start instituting reform. So, of course, that business grouping, capitalists, white capitalists, etc., they had a huge start on blacks who now, within the new situation, had opportunities and equal opportunities. But by 1990, as a result of the sanctions, but particularly because in the long run, apartheid was no good for the development of a modern economy, which is going to be the case with Zionism. What happened was since is that the South African economy took off remarkably. We've hit the same kind of problem as everywhere else, so I'm not referring to the fact of how we're going to deal with it now. But a black middle class had emerged as well. And this is helping to make a big difference in terms of spreading the economic benefits. But I can link this into the last question, because we've got 47 million people. of which something like 35 million are indigenous, original black Africans who were living in dire poverty. And then there's the mixed race group and the those of Asian origin, etc. So we've got to deal with eradicating the poverty and the legacy of decades and decades. The budget favors the poor, the health, the education aspect of the budget is massive, but we're lacking in capacity of being able to utilize that. And just as an example, at the municipal level, where in the past we didn't have municipalities in black areas, in the rural areas. So you had good municipalities working for the white areas, 5 million whites. And now to have developed the project managers, the skills, the acumen to use that money to develop those municipalities where the delivery system is, has been a big problem, and that slowed things up. So of course we face people who are frustrated, people who are saying things are going too slowly, and there are difficulties of that kind. In terms of what are these overall lessons, there's a very big difference between an anti-colonial struggle and coming to power and creating a state now that has to serve all the people and dealing with a whole range of issues which the Freedom Charter identified, from education, the justice system, overall the economy, the land question, and so on. And from that point of view, in a world where we've had big problems, unipolar world, the domination of the United States, countries like ours which have very little opportunities from elsewhere, having to try and fit into the global economy and getting things right in our situation, we've made big strides. The economy was growing at 5-6% a year. It was helping to wipe out the unemployment. It was creating a much better situation materially for our people. And we now started finding the same problems that people are finding elsewhere in the world. We couldn't move, according to the Freedom Charter, towards a socialist approach, basically because there was no longer a socialist world there to enable trading partners other than Western capitalist trading partners. And perhaps one of the reasons why de Klerk was able to take that decision he did at the end of 89, 90, etc., was because the Soviet Union clearly was in decline and the West were no longer that worried about the Soviet Union and South Africa becoming part of the Soviet sphere of influence. I mean, that's something that one is debating in terms of what helped to bring about the change.